This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
You're going on that journey with me? Good morning. There's a Jewish body of writing called the Zohar, Z-O-H-A-R, and it's a mythical body. It's part of the larger corpus that you might know as the Kabbalah. And it says that for every issue, every problem, every directive, every thing, there is a key that opens up that door. So you have to find the key. But the key of music, it says, opens all the doors. So the fact that we begin with a little bit of music and sharing that way hopefully can communicate a sense of generosity, a sense of goodness, a sense of aspirational sharing in ways that I could just, you know, words cannot do. So I'm very, very happy to be back at St. David's Episcopal. Thank you very much for the kind invitation. Dr. West, thank you, and for the community as well. And I hope that y'all are doing okay or good enough. This is sort of an introduction class to Judaism, Judaism 101. So that's, you're in the right place. Maybe I'm not. Ben, thanks for singing with me. So I was thinking that I would speak for just a little bit, and then if y'all had questions or sharings or, like, I heard, you know, this or that, then we can have a conversation. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. By the way, I don't purport to have any answers, but I'll just do the best I can. Is that okay with you too?
Sure.
So you're like, well, we heard something different. Plausibly true. So if I wanted you to know anything about Judaism, anything at all, and I see that you're all taking notes assiduously, thank you very much. Is that Judaism privileges the question more than the answer. So if I wanted you to know anything, just know that the questions are important. Answers are nice, but questions are essential. And the ways that we, in fact, study or pray or do what we do is a way of asking questions about our purpose, about the world at large, and about things in themselves. So rather than say, for me to say to my community, if you just do these three things or these four things, if you believe this or you observe that, everything's going to be fine. For me, it would be, I don't know, and let's see if we can figure it out together. So that method of becoming is embedded in our study and in our prayer. Okay? So that's basically all I wanted to say today. Thank you so very much. So I believe that Judaism is a beautiful wisdom tradition. It is not the only truth. I think there are many, many truths out there. It is something that I grew up with. So just a little bit about me that Dr. West didn't mention. I grew up in Chicago. Nobody? Okay, good. I grew up in Chicago through high school and moved to New Orleans. Please, best cotton bowl ever. Too late. It doesn't matter. I had to for a second. And you're like, so I lived in New Orleans. That's where I met my wife. And we got married in New Orleans and moved to New York City. Nobody? Okay, good. Whatever. Moved there and then did my seminary work there. And then moved to Austin just 25 years ago. So anybody been there in Austin that long? So I've been here since 1998. And I've raised my three kids here. My kids are older. And they're exploring the world as well. So I've been at this congregation of Yudhis Achim for that long. And I do believe that having the opportunity to get to know the larger community and to share in the larger community, and importantly for me, to learn from others in the larger community is really, really important. So what do I want to tell you about Judaism specifically? And I'm just speaking now so you guys are thinking about good questions, okay? I'm just going to talk until somebody has a question. So I want you to think about it, because I could just, again, tell you different things. We have a sacred book. It's called the Tanakh. You all heard that book before? We would call it the Hebrew Bible. Some of you might call it the Old Testament. Are we still friends? Are we doing okay? So that is comprised of the five books of Moses, the books of prophets, of like Isaiah, Ezekiel, shaking their head. Okay, Jeremiah, those books. And then it also has the books called the writings, which are, in my house growing up, my mom, blessed memory, had a drawer where she kept like all stuff that we didn't know we needed, like rubber bands and toothpicks and stuff like that. It was like a drawer. That's the books of writings. If you don't know what to do with it, you put it in here. Like Psalms and Songs of Songs and Proverbs and Job, all the good books, right? So those are very important to us. And from there launches generations of learning that we would call oral Torah, O-R-A-L, oral Torah, differentiated from the Torah itself, the five books, which are called the written Torah. Okay? So the written Torah, the five books, everything else, including the prophets and the writings and everything that has been written and everything that is being said right now, is the oral Torah. Okay? Everybody all right? Didn't lose anybody? We just can la la la. Okay, we're good again. And then from these moments, we are finding ourselves back in a common place at a common time, and that is the revelation of Mount Sinai. Okay. Has anybody been to Mount Sinai? Kind of a trick question. Did you all have been to the covenant, or the convent, I should say, in the Sinai? Is that right? Right? That's got a great gift shop. But the idea is that maybe that's the place where the revelation happened. Maybe it isn't. As you might remember in the book of Deuteronomy, which is part of the Hebrew Bible, that it says that Moses, who went up to Mount Nebo to look out at the promised land, when he died, he was buried in a place that nobody knows. In that sense, and I just, again, as Dr. West mentioned, I had an opportunity to share Israel, Christian and Jewish holy sites with 45 people. Just got back. I was a little nervous because I was on the flight for 2.5 hours, and then they said, canceled, sorry. So I'm the miracle that I'm here this morning. I'm so super happy, so glad. And the idea is that the Mount Sinai is not known necessarily, unlike all the other wonderful places that we've been, like the Church of the Nativity or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or Masada or all of the other wonderful things that you'll visit when you have a chance to go to Israel. Those are all sort of known or probable places. Mount Sinai is something that's more mythological, but not in a way that like you don't believe it, more in a way that its power comes in the feelings that you get as opposed to what you might see actually there. So the idea is that the written Torah and the oral Torah, or basically all of Judaism, were given directly to the people there, the children of Israel, who were gathered to receive directly the presence of God. And that's found in the book of Exodus and stuff. I don't want to ruin the story if you haven't read it, but it's... Okay. So everything emanates from that place. So everything that has been given and everything that hopefully we will discover in our life's way is found in this place of Mount Sinai. Now, there's a classical conversation. I told you what's the thing that I want you to know about Judaism. Question matters more than me. Right. So rather than me just saying that, people like, oh, that's a really interesting idea, that engendered some conversation and some questions among some of the ancient rabbis. And the question, classical question is, well, did Mount Sinai just happen once? And it was like an interesting thing that we, or is Mount Sinai happening always? And we just have to attune our ear to the revelations of God. So we're going to vote. So the idea, and that's, by the way, spoiler alert, that's not resolved. So it doesn't really matter if you think it was a historical event and something that happened, and we're sort of still getting the good vibes from that, or that if we listen and have a life of spiritual existence and community, that we can actually hear the resonances of Mount Sinai if they continue to this day. So that's just a classical question. But the texts themselves bloom into every generation has their own question. So our goal is not necessarily to live Judaism as it was lived in the generation of Moses and the children of Israel. They were in Egypt enslaved, and it wasn't such a great thing. So what our deal is that we want to learn from every generation and begin to think about Judaism as it exists in a way that we can make sense of our life. Now, so there is a lot of different ways to do that. So the two, you're here, which is great and surprising and good for me, But the two sort of like questions that I was going to answer, I'm going to answer them, and then I'm going to ask for your questions, where the first thing is, what's the deal with covenant? And what's the deal with chosen people? Okay? So I'm going to do those two things. I could do more, but I'd rather hear from you. Is that okay? So that's your 2.5 minute warning that questions are coming from you. So the idea of covenant was perhaps given, by the way, who was the first Jewish person? Somebody said it. It is not a trick question, everybody. Abraham hears the voice of God who's living and says, go to the land that I will show you. This is Genesis 12. And Abraham does and gets to the land called Canaan or Canaan, and then immediately has to leave because there's a famine. So that's an interesting question, saying that Abraham says, I will reboot my life in order to hear the voice that that I'm hearing. I will go to the land. I will connect to the land. And then all of a sudden, I can't stay in the land because there's not enough food in the land. So the covenant comes through Abraham and through a particular ritual that is still being practiced in Judaism called a circumcision or a brit milah with boys. And in our modern times, a public naming ceremony for girls. Right? So the idea is, what is that covenant? That covenant is that there is a relationship with God that is honest, authentic, and symbiotic or mutual. The idea being that God asks us to be holy, and God asks us to bring holiness into the world. The holiness in the world, there's a whole way of doing that called mitzvot. You may have heard of the word mitzvah, like bar mitzvah, which is the best name for a drinking establishment ever. So I can tell that joke was good value. Students get really upset when I bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah is something that you may have heard of, and it's when a child who's 12 or 13 says that they are going to devote their lives to pursuing mitzvot. So what is this mitzvot? Mitzvot is usually translated as good deeds, which is nice and adorable, but it really means commandment. And in the Torah, even though they're not necessarily stated explicitly, our sages say that there are 613 commandments. It's a lot. You thought 10 was a ton, right? But the idea is that some things that we do, some things that we don't do, some things are time-bound, some things are done only when we're in a particular place. So it's not oppressive. The idea, if I could just back it up and say, that every moment that we live and share is a moment of intention. So let me just say that. It's not about fulfilling my needs specifically. It's not about getting what I think I need to get, but it's rather about developing one's emotional intelligence. It's about doing good deeds or commandments for others as well, bringing holiness into the world. And that doesn't mean that you can't enjoy life, because we in fact believe a lot in delight, D-E-L-I-G-H-T, but the idea is that we are always looking to connect to someone on a deeper level. And that would be the hope that the covenant. In exchange, the idea is that God hopefully will shower us with blessing. Who knows? Because, you know, again, the question is the bottom line for us, not the answer. And it's not, by the way, if there's any lawyers in here, it's not a quid pro quo. It doesn't mean that I'm going to do 14 weeks ago today, therefore I get this thing. It's not like a rewards program on a credit card, right? Rather, it's an idea that I'm going to devote my life to commandments, I'm going to devote my life to looking out for others, to fixing the world, to helping others, and if there are blessings that come my way in return, lovely. However, there's no guarantee that that will be the case. Okay? Is that something you sign up for? Who knows? But it is what it is. So the idea that embedded in this idea of mitzvot or covenant is another term that you might have heard of. It's really fun to watch some candidates run for office in like New York and New Jersey, where there's more sizable Jewish population, because they'll put on something like this called a yarmulke, which is worn to share that there's an awe or a presence of God always, especially when you're on I-35 or MoPA. But But the candidates will put this on and they'll say words like tikkun olam. You guys heard that word, those words before? Right. Just saying, tikkun olam literally means fixing the world. And that is embedded in the part of sort of the job or the function of a Jewish person or a Jewish life is, again, not just to sort of get, but to give. And to give so that the world is transformed for the better. I can give you sort of mystical arguments for that, which I appreciate, but I just wanted to lay that out. So the covenant is that we believe and appreciate God's word. And unlike some of our Christian friends, we believe that this world is the only world, that our reward is not in heaven. Still friends? But that we're going to do the, only like three people laugh. What am I going to do? So the idea is that we're going to do the best we can to fix God's world and hope for the best.
Okay.
The Psalms, which we are big fans of, say that, you know, this is the world of the living, and this is the day that God has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it, which means that we should do the best that we can to make it better always. Okay? So again, we're not hedging our bets for something else. That's basically covenant. Everybody okay? Lovely. So questions coming in about a minute. So the next thing I wanted to talk about, just it was on the blurb for the class, is chosen. Now, I know that it's very misunderstood, and I'm saying it's very misunderstood also by Jewish people. But the idea is that chosenness doesn't mean better than. It doesn't mean varsity. Okay? And everybody else is like junior, but it doesn't mean what it means to me in a way that I actually appreciate living into my Judaism is that my life is sacred. And by the way, by extension, your lives are sacred, but I only can have control of my own life sometimes, not even that. But I want to do the best I can with my life. That there's a holiness to my life. My life, even though it might seem absurd or ironic or frustrating or scary or difficult, no matter where it may be in that place, that there is a sense that I am in this place for a reason. And to me, there's a chosenness to it. Again, not to be compared to other people, but to recognize that in the very few short breaths that I get in this world, that they matter in this world. So there's a chosenness, which means that there's a connection to God that is personalized and that is encouraged for me to live my best self. There is a tendency in our civilization to pigeonhole ourselves, right? We go to work, we might go to church on Sunday, we might have a relationship with our family here, we might have work buddies or whatever. So everything is, we have different identities. How many of you have more than one email address? Okay, how many of you have an Instagram? I'm gonna just do this. How many of you have a Finstagram, which is like the gram that you don't tell your other friends that you have? I'll do this with my kids. But the idea is that we have these sort of broken or hackneyed experiences. And the whole idea, the one Hebrew word that I'm sure you all know is what? Shalom. And what does shalom mean? But it also means wholeness. It means contentment. It means that we try to move beyond the very individual or specific identities that we have and try to integrate our life in a way that makes sense. Very often we're taught that we sort of, you know, do this thing at work, we do this thing at home, we do these things with the friends that we trust, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying that's bad. And what I'm saying is that there's a sense to try to integrate all that we are and not hide or not conceal who we are based on the circumstances that we're in, if that makes any sense. So the idea is that covenant means that I'm going to do something hopefully beyond myself for the better. And chosenness means that I am called to do so because I have the privilege and the honor of being in this world. I didn't choose to be in the world, but I'm in the world. So therefore, I want to make the most of my life. So those would be two very important elements that might be misunderstood. I know whenever I'm lonely, this is true. Whenever I'm lonely, which is not very often, but sometimes, I will take a Southwest flight to Love Field. And I will wait in the airport just with this on, and somebody will inevitably come up to me like 5 minutes, and like, are you from Israel? And tell me how much they love the chosen people. And that's cool because it's not exactly the way that I see myself. And it's not exactly that there's some sort of insider or some sort of revered knowledge that I get, rather than I realize that if God has created this world, and I am thus of the world, and I'm a creation of God, and that therefore I'm partners with God to try to do the work that God, in God's infinitude, asked me to do. And that's what I wanted to say. So I will, in fact, finish, well, with the idea that if God is everything, God consciously withdrew a little bit from this world. It's called in Hebrew tzimtzum, making space for each of us. And what God wants for us to do is bring the world back into a wholeness that God created. And God can only do that through our agents. So I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but that's one I wanted to tell you. We all gathered at Mount Sinai. One of the, if y'all know maybe the dating apps, you guys haven't heard about these dating apps, they're heading on. Anyway, one of the dating, this is true, it's going to sound funny, but one of the dating apps in the Jewish world for Jewish people to meet each other is called Saw You at Sinai. Isn't that cute? Well, that goes to the idea that everybody who ever was, is, and will be was at that point of revelation when we received the direct access to God. And if we think about it that way, then we're all connected and we all have this work to do to repair the world and to get to know ourselves as best we can. So more to say, however, questions, I hope, and let's have a conversation for the rest of our time. That's all right. I'm honored to be with you. Anybody have anything? Please, well, come on up and introduce yourself and say hello and let me know how wrong I am.
Rabbi, my name is Laurie Iserlo. Our friend in common is Beth Mayan.
Oh, sure. She was in Israel with me.
She's a friend of mine.
Nice.
So I love what you had to say today. I will say that I think as, well, here we're called Episcopalian. Globally, we're called Anglicans. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have some things in common, one of which is that in classic Anglicanism, we emphasize the questions over the answers. In fact, our rector here finished his sermon today with a question. So that's something we have in common. The other thing we have in common is that we're also called the frozen chosen, although I don't think that's really compared to modern day love to sing and I love the love. Anyway, maybe it used to be that way. So here's my question. I find that since we're a global religion and we have people coming into our church all the time, they really want answers. They don't want questions. They want answers. Now, my mother or grandmother would say, well, that's too bad. We don't need to worry about that. But people do want answers. And I'm kind of curious about that. So if we come from this traditional, both your tradition and mine have that in common. And maybe I'm comfortable with that. And maybe you're comfortable with that. But what do you say to people who come to you and say, I don't want that. I want answers.
Thank you very much, Laurie. I appreciate that. I have a tremendous respect for Anglicans as well. My group that just went to Israel, we went last Sunday, a week from today, to St. George Episcopal Church in Jerusalem. And it was a really beautiful, it was epiphany, and it was a really beautiful service. And it was in English and Arabic, actually, because it was in East Jerusalem. It was quite interesting. And I know the people who were with me really enjoyed it. And I happen to be reading, I really like literature. Happy to be reading the second volume of a biography of T.S. Eliot, who chose to become an Anglican basically in his late 30s. And I'm reading much more about his religious poetry, like Ash Wednesday and others, that is really interesting and I have a tremendous knowledge base of learning more about the Anglican tradition. So thank you for that. What I would say to somebody who says, I want answers, and I want them to know I want answers, is that if that's great, we'll devote yourself to practice. Is what I would say. I cannot give you answers. If you want to say, how do I observe the Sabbath, or I keep kosher, what is that? I can do that for you. But answers about meaning, answers about purpose in life and drive, I think only come in the journey itself, only come in the becoming of someone. Because if someone demands an answer here, anybody who's ever been on the internet, you guys know. So what happens when you go to Google and you get your answer? What do you do? What do you do? You either stop, like, oh, now I know the net worth of, I don't know, whatever. Or you keep looking. Oh, that's interesting. Well, what about this? To me, the idea is that search is, to me, the spiritual practice that one desires. So when somebody says they want an anchor, what I do, and I'm sure your rector and others who are here as well, would say there's always a question behind the question. When I give counsel to people, and maybe you have this too in your work, if you're with somebody, let's say for an hour, for 55 minutes, there's a conversation and some sharing, and then they say thank you, and they put their hand on the door. They're like, actually, do you do one more? And that's actually what they came to talk to you, right? So the better, closer, the sooner that I get to that question, the more time I stay here. Right? Oh, because then what are you like, oh, cool, but I got to, like, oh, that's really what you wanted to ask. So we'll come down and sit down and let's talk about it. But the idea is that I think when people are asking for something either exclusive or binary or yes or no, that there's something behind that, and to sort of listen as radically as one can to hear what they're really asking. So I would resist saying, here's what you need to do, and saying, I invite you to learn more about spiritual practice, whether learning or praying or social service or whatever you're going to do, and see if you can find a way through there. Well, because what I've noticed in the 25 years of leading a congregation is that many people are lonely. Many people are looking for connection. And they think because, you know, I represent something that I can give it to them quickly. Whereas I think something that takes longer and is more authentic to them will last them in a term much more than I will. So does that answer your question, Lori?
It does. I think it still goes back to people wanting easy answers, and we don't really provide that.
Well, then we're doing. So, you know, that's, to me, I can guide and I can direct. I do know some things. But to give somebody an answer for their purpose or why they're doing what they're doing, I think only comes in the experiences of doing. So thank you. It's a great question. Other, well, please step right up.
Hi. My name is Laura. Maybe you can help me find a question underneath my question. I think about the relationship of place and displacement. When I think of Judaism, I think of sacred places and keeping sacred places, but I also think of diaspora and exile and having to make place someplace new. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really curious about what can we learn about that kind of interplay of keeping place and then being displaced.
Amazing. Thank you, Laura. I actually spoke a little bit about this yesterday at our service. Coming back from Israel, had this pilgrimage trip, and we talked about the specialness of all these amazing places, and yet they're seen only through a particular lens. In Judaism, many of the great places in our tradition, like the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, which is where Sarah and Abraham were ancestors, you guys are just one person's on their head, right? That's built by Herod. The Temple Mount is built by Herod. Masada, built by Herod. So the idea is that you're seeing something only through the lens of a particular person in a particular time. We went to amazing churches or amazing spots. All the churches, basically, for the most part, were designed by an Italian 20th century architect named Antonio Barluzzi. They're beautiful, but what does that have to do with the Mount of Beatitude? You know, I mean, it's cool, but it's there somewhere. So the idea is that the ancient rabbis, again, inspired by Deuteronomy and saying, we don't know where Moses is, so don't look for him, is that the rabbis transformed the idea of place worship, even though Jerusalem is really important, into a recognition that our texts become our land, become our place. So through the study of our texts comes a yearning and a longing that can actually help us adjust to whatever political system is in front of us or whatever exile happens, and helps us, if you won't mind me saying, it's a little bit much for your question, helps us to endure the trials of and traumas of displacement that are endemic, unfortunately, to our experience. So rather than yearn for what was, we can yearn for what is, which is the text that we study. And it's not just learning at a removal. It's learning that we are an essential voice in that conversation. Because what do our texts say? They tell us stories. But the classical text that we do study is called the Talmud, T-A-L-M-U-D. And that's just basically a bunch of people talking to each other, asking questions. It might be inspired by a quote from your favorite Bible book, like Exodus or Leviticus. I'm reading this correctly. The idea is that it begins a conversation that ultimately goes into like a blog post and fan fiction and comments on YouTube. It becomes something much bigger and much more personalized, that when we study it, we are actually part of that text. That it can't be, that it's not complete until our voice is heard in it. So we may be studying with a friend across the table, but we may also be arguing with some of the ancient sages like Rabbi Akiva or Hillel or whoever it might be, that we're all in the conversation together. Therefore, while we recognize that what is really powerful and important, it too will change, it will pass. So for example, if you came to my congregation, which is in Northwest Hills, it's on the Dell Jewish Community Campus, it's called the Gudas Achim, and you came into our beautiful sanctuary, which is stunning, and you came up to our ark, which holds our books of Torah, which we have 9 of them, if you came, you'd see that on the top, the big imposing brass doors, copper doors, there is a calendar that is to evoke the golden age of Judaism in Babylon. Now, does that surprise you? Where's Babylon today? Iraq. How many Jews are there now? No. Okay? Maybe 2. But the idea is that that's where the golden age of rabbinic Judaism flowered. The doors themselves were constructed. Remember, I told you there's an intentionality in Judaism. The doors themselves were constructed in which country? They're beautiful doors. They're made in Germany. Okay? And that was done on purpose. And the whole thing, the whole beautiful sanctuary, which has been written up in architectural, right? It's an American amazing thing. It's great, but it's an American thing. So, but if you see that there's Babylonian influence, there's German influence, and there's American, everything is not static. Everything changes. So while we study our text and we end high points in our year, like the Passover Seder or the end of Yom Kippur, we sing the song, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. Well, somebody might say, wait a second, you were just in Jerusalem, like less than 48 hours, what do you mean next year in Jerusalem? Well, it becomes much more of a mythos. It becomes much more of an aspiration rather than being in Jerusalem. Because you know what happened? I got food poisoning in Jerusalem. That's not the song I want to sing. Right? But Jerusalem is the aspiration of something bigger and better. And it doesn't displace the actual place by no means. But can we live beyond the difficulties that we have in relating to or existing in a particular place as administrations come and go, or as migrations come and go, or as we try to make sense of the modern state of Israel? We can. But that in itself shouldn't become or transform a religion, which was founded because of a displacement. Which rabbinic Judaism, again, small history lesson, was founded after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in this year 70 CE, destroyed by the Romans. So the Jews who survived that, which were not a lot, kind of said, well, now what do we do? Because we can't go back to Jerusalem, the place of pilgrimage. Let's make a religion that is portable. And that is actually something that we've been doing today. There are certainly attempts to say, no, we have Jerusalem. Let's worship that and there. But to me, that is a different way of thinking that does not allow the rabbinic genius of worshiping no matter where and how, and studying no matter where and how, and allowing the text to determine our deep connections to what is in a timeless way, rather than in a way that is contingent on place. Thanks. Other questions, other thoughts, other ideas? Yes, please, come on.
I'm not sure what you said at all.
Because I know it's going to be thoughtful. I'll be like, oh, I wish I had said that.
I don't know if I have a question as much as a comment. First of all, I said this when you walked in the door earlier. I've known you for many years. You are a blessing to this community, to the larger interfaith community. And for that, I'm grateful. And I think many people are. But I just had this memory, which I sort of forgot about, But about 20 years ago, I was sitting in your office. And I was talking about the organization I was working for. And I mentioned to you that my mother was sick. And he asked me, what's her name? I said, Edith. You made this beautiful prayer, which I didn't understand, except when you said, Edith. And then I understood. My mother died not too long after that. But that's a beautiful memory and a gift that you are. And the beautiful sanctuary that you do have at Agudas Akim, which I've been to many times. So thank you again for remembering my mother, Edith. A beautiful name. I guess if I do have a question, some years ago, a friend of mine who was also Jewish sort of surprised me when he said this. I don't know what we were talking about in terms of maybe heaven or not. And he said something to the effect of, you know, I live this life, live it well, when it ends, it ends. And that took me back. I couldn't understand it. And you alluded to it a few minutes ago when you first started. Could you say something more about that belief?
For sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. May your mother's memory be a blessing. And let me just say this. I know there's some folks who serve the church here as well. More than anything that I could ever preach or teach, you know what people tell me that they remember from me is when I call them on their birthday.
Oh, jeez.
That's real. So I could think that I'm going to give this amazing address that's going to galvanize their community, but people, that connection 20 years ago, thank you, Jim. I'm debating whether or not to tell the story, but I don't think I will. I'm going to stay right with your question. I'm going to go back to this book that I started with called the Zohar. There are many different names of God in the Jewish tradition. Doesn't mean there's many gods, but it means that there are many aspects or attributes or ideas like a diamond that you can see different ways to look at. If you're a poetry fan, one of my favorites is Wallace Stevens, 12 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. It's a very similar idea. So there's a name of God that resonates very, very deeply for me. And that name is not the name that God gives Moses in the book of Exodus, which is Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, I will be what I will be. Or if you're a Popeye fan, I am what I am. That's lovely. It's a very important name of God. And that might serve us well in our philosophy of life. Like, you know, how do we say in French, que sera, sera? Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, right? So that's really important. But you're asking more to me a deeper question of what happens after we die or what's the deal? Why is there no like round two or season two? And the name of God in the Zohar, which is very important, is Ein Sof, E-I-N-S-O-F. And it means there is no end. Or it means, if you will, infinity. And the idea that I'm actually working on quite a bit now is how to make sense of this without having to give, you know, all sorts of introductions and clarifications. But basically, the idea is that our soul is timeless, and our soul belongs to God. And when we die in this world, our body either decomposes or whatever. We don't have to get into that right now. Judaism does not traditionally endorse cremation. For a lot of reasons, but that's another question. But the idea of the soul reattaching itself and becoming the Ein Sof in the larger world beyond the specificity of who I am or who you are is something really important. If you remember that old Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory, remember that? Remember the old one, Mike TV? Remember the guy who was like, you know, who was big and then he ate or whatever he did? And then he was in the ether and he became the little Mike. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's where we're so that idea of not the body, but the soul is that it's all around us all the time and it's imbued within us as well. So there is no more specificity of who I am, but there's a connection that who I am is joined to the larger infinity of what is. There is an importance. You guys believe in science? Are you pro DNA in here? So I know where I talked about it. So just like there would be like a constitution of a genetic code through the DNA, to me there's a spiritual DNA as well, which is why who you are, your family, and all that stuff. How many of you said that you laugh like your grandmother? Or that you have your eyes of your great grandfather? Or that you look at a picture like somebody I know, 23andMe, you guys know what that is? Fascinating. I will never do it because I don't want any of my cousins to be arrested. But somebody I know did this and they found that, you know, there was a brother and from their parent that they had never known about. That happens all the time. It's amazing. But then we saw the picture, they're like, oh my God, it's like, wow. It's like they look exactly the same. So, you know, it's a very interesting idea that as the physical is passed together, so is the spiritual. So it's not just that, you know, I'm going to come back as a duck or a rock or something like that. That's valid and important. But in Judaism, the idea is that who you are spiritually with your family, with the people that you choose to make, if you have children, that all becomes part of the larger nexus of you when you're in part of the larger universe. So it's not that we would have a place in heaven that's reserved for us. It's not that Neil Blumenthal is going to be carried on throughout my life, but the essences of what I've brought into the world and who I am will be part of, if you prefer, the zeitgeist or the in soap of what this world is for it to be hopefully a blessing, which is why I think we're dealing with such difficulty, because the things that we know about in history, whether it's recent history or past history, that have been very, very violent and very difficult, they've never passed. I think the quote by William Faulkner is true. The idea that the past has never passed, but we're still dealing with it, even if we don't know that we're dealing with it today. We're dealing with it in the energies in the world. So I don't necessarily have a place, but hopefully all that I've done and all that I hopefully am in my essence will be transmitted and become part of God for the world to come. Anybody else? Maybe one or two, please. Hi.
My name is Ellen Jockish. There's a lot of, this is much more prosaic question, Roger's question, just the decline in mainline Christianity, church attendance, and maybe that has to do with people that don't want to wrestle with questions. But I wonder in Judaism if that is something that you struggle with as well and how you understand that.
Thanks, Ellen. There's a joke that says, how do you know when somebody, you guys remember telegrams?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So a Jewish person got a telegram from a Jewish friend that said, start worrying, details to follow. If we just have to worry about something, we worry about it. I'm a big believer in just doing the best I can and seeing what happens. And yes, I go to so many, you know, conferences and what we do. But, you know, I haven't seen it in a long time. But when I was studying, there was a teacher of mine, if you remember Life magazine?
Yeah.
And it was like a headline from like 1962. 1962 is the end of Judaism? Question mark. Okay. Maybe. But, you know, I think everyone asks that question in order to try to, what's the question behind the question, right? How am I relevant? Is what I'm doing actually interesting? And if it's not interesting to me, how could it possibly be interesting to other people? You know, we're all trying to recruit the younger generation. Right? So, again, there's philosophies of that. To me, it's about being as authentic as possible and not pretending that certain things are going to substitute for the larger questions asked. And again, I don't have any judgment about whatever happens in other realms, but the first rule that I have for myself, because sometimes I just kind of look at myself in the rabbi's office. I'm like, why am I here? Like, what is going on? Like, is this my life? But my point being is that what am I leading a congregation that I myself would want to be a member of? And I'm a tough customer. So if I can start with that, and again, I know I'm of a particular age and a particular demographic, and but if I can start with that, if I can have good people around me, whether professionals or volunteers, who represent other diverse viewpoints, I think that's a really good start. So whether it may be sort of a dip or precipitous decline or something, you know, all of that doesn't keep me up at night. More than what would keep me up at night is, am I doing the best that I can do? And am I helping people and taking the time for people? Because once it becomes about serving the process of the synagogue or the thing, and less about concentrating on the people, I need to reevaluate what I'm doing. Does that help? Yes, sir, please.
Hello, my name is Mark. This is maybe more of an academic question, but as you know, the Christian Bible has been translated many times, possibly to the Paul. And I'm curious about the Hebrew Bible, if it is translated, and kind of with the Christian Old Testament, like how does the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament compare today with the translation?
Great. Thanks, Mark. It's a great question. We do a major feature of our Saturday morning services is the reading of the Torah in the Hebrew. However, we don't assume that people know what it is always. So the idea is that we have a book that has Hebrew and English in it, and so people can follow along, et cetera, et cetera. And I think without translations, we would be at a deficit. However, we do attempt even once or twice a week, which anybody who's learned a language knows that's not sufficient, even with Duolingo. So we attempt and recognize that our prayers are in Hebrew, but we do have translations as well. So I think that's really important. Your question about the translations of text is a really good question. So I, as was mentioned, I teach at from time to time at the Presbyterian Seminary, and I teach a course called the Introduction to Hebrew Bible. I had them change it from Introduction to Old Testament, to their credit. But the idea is that there are translations, and they do matter. And translations themselves are a commentary. So rather than, you know, sort of tell everyone, okay, by the end of the semester, you all should learn Hebrew, which is, I think, unrealistic, I would pick one that would be translated from a Jewish perspective. So the Jewish Publication Society, what's it called? The Jewish Study Bible would be one that I would ask my students to learn, just because it's connected in a way that that in a translation, it is more faithful to the Hebrew text. I've spent years studying the Vulgate, which is Saint Jerome. Okay, nobody, but you know, studied the translated the Bible into Latin. And as a student of Latin, I think it was really interesting. You know, everyone has their own way of thinking, but I think you're absolutely right. There are what I would call Hebrew Bible translations, and there are Old Testament translations. And I just want to plug, since I do teach from time to time also at the Seminary of the Southwest. And I would team teach a course, although my partner has just moved, who is a member here. You guys know Dan Johnson, senior pastor. Yeah. So Dan was my partner, and he really was very generous in crafting a course with me called The Undoing of Anti-Judaism in the Early Church, which is what we paid attention to translations, we paid attention to agenda and other things as well. So it all matters. And to stand in front of a class of presumptive pastors and to ask them to read, let's say, Isaiah differently rather than how they've learned it is an interesting exercise. And while there may be some resistance but the reality, again, going back to the idea of seeing things from different perspectives, I think it's a really interesting understanding that with respect, we can see each other, we can see the same text and can read it differently, the same words, which I think is really important. Maybe one more, is that something we can do? Yes, please. Maybe just one more in short. I don't want to have you be late for church, that would be bad for me.
It's Robin. I wanted to ask you if you referenced Mount Sinai so much in your introduction, mm-hmm. and what a pivotal part of your tradition that is. Is it the giving of the Ten Commandments? Is that what y'all call a pivotal event? Is for your understanding?
Great, Robin. Thank you. The answer is yes and. So yes, it's the Ten Commandments. Yes, it's the giving of the entire Torah, both written and oral. But more than any of that, it is a direct revelation, at least initially, of God's self. So there, that's the moment. So if you read the text, which we can do another time, you'll see that the people gathered. This is Exodus 20, right? So the 19 and 20. So the idea is the people and God appeared to the people. And what did the people do? They went, oh, man. Moses, can you do this for us, please? Because this is a lot. But it leads in the initial first commandment, as we understand, that the people had an unexpurgated or a direct relationship with God. And that is what we're creating. That is the so-called mystical experience, that we had this life-changing experience that we still feel is in the air for us, and that we want to share with each other to make sure that maybe it will happen again. So that idea of connection directly is the thing that makes Mount Sinai so. I don't want to overstep my time. I really appreciate all of you. Thank you very much for the generous invitation.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.